Hello again. This is a recording of a teaching session which occurred on June 11th, 1997, here at Holden Village. This session is entitled My Ghanaian Community, and the presenter is Sister Rosina Ampa.
Reverend Sister Rosina Ampa from the Order of St. Helena. And this is the continuation of our discussion about community. And today we are going to talk about the Ghanaian community where I grew up. So basically, I'm going to have to tell you, and then please, you can interject questions. If you want me to stop, put up a hand and I will stop before I go too far, but I'm just going to start. And since you don't know about the culture, I'm just going to talk. The Ghanaian culture, as every culture, is very different. It's different in a way that, as all Africans, they have belief in God, God the Creator. They also believe in the ancestors that they are still with us when they depart from us. And so it's very important that a child from that country respect God, God the Creator. And a Ghanaian child or a Ghanaian human being will never say anything, tomorrow I will do so, so and so, without indicating if God permits. It's part of the language. Say Razibuim Abua, which means if God opens me the door, I will do so, so and so. You never say anything without first indicating that, which is very important in a culture, knowing that your life is in the hands of God. So I grew up in an environment where that was emphasized. I was born into a praying community, which was my nuclear family, my dad and my mom. My dad was a school principal and a choir director. And so when I was growing up, all I knew was in the morning you pray together as a family. In the evening, you pray together before you go to bed. So prayer was center of my life. And not only I alone, most of the families, they pray together. Prayer is very important in that small country because of the relationship with God and the people. As a child, before I was aware and started noticing the importance of what it is, I realized that there were times my aunt or my uncles will come and take any of us from the family to sometimes go and stay there for a while, and then we will come back. And I also realized that there were other cousins who grew up with us. I was one of eight, or I'm one of eight, and then I have four half brothers and sisters. So it's a large family. And also, it's even larger because we have other cousins who come to stay, and sometimes I will go and stay with other people in the family. When I was 4 years old, I was taken to the mission house when my father was sick. And according to the priest, I was such a special child. I walked very early and I talked very early. And it's like they always say, well, since I was born, the world has never been the same. Because I'm always cracking jokes. I'm always making people laugh, even as a child. But as I was growing up in the culture, I noticed within the community, especially closer in my family, what my mother would do for us children is when you go out and another child start fighting with you and you come back to your mother screaming, What my mother would do is send you back out. Go defend yourself. You want me to go fight for you? It's just like you. Good. So I learned how to fight for myself. And I mean, after a while, they really were sorry that they told me that, because I was beating people left and right. So, but my father, on the other hand, was the quiet one. So, you know, as children, we nicknamed my mom and my dad. We call my dad Job in the Bible, because dad, everything dad will tell you about God and how these things work. And my mother, we nicknamed her like a small elephant, because she was big and tall. And when she's angry and step here, you have to give her way. So we used to call her small elephant. You just stay aside before she stampede on you. And so, you know, we would joke like this. But the other thing I noticed in the culture was that in the evening, the uncles, the older people, were gathered together as we've gathered here, and they would tell us stories. They would tell us stories, sometimes part historically true, or sometimes they would just tell us folk stories. And each story has wisdom. And when they are telling the story, they will ask you to listen, because next time they will ask you to tell the story. And when they tell the story, they will ask you to come with the wisdom in the story. So you have to listen. The other thing is, because it's an oral culture, they will send you miles away to take message to an aunt or uncle. And you have to listen. And you have to pay attention, because you're going to go a distance. And if you don't remember, you have to come back again and get the message. So you pay attention, you really listen. You train your ears and you train your eyes, you train your whole senses, because it's like your guard or guide. So as I was maturing in the culture, I was a child that asked questions a lot. I wanted to know everything. And so I would say, and now what's this? Why did you do that? And why not this way? And so they are always responding to my inquiries and questions. And I was also very aggressive. So I got a lot of stories. Because instead of sometimes a parent beating you or doing something, they would say, sit down, let me tell you a story. And then they would tell you a story with a profound meaning, and then you have to make the decision for yourself. So not only are they helping you to grow, but they are helping you to think, use your own mind, what is right and what is wrong. Another thing I learned in the culture growing up that I used to ask questions a lot was that when somebody is even not related to your family, is doing something out of the way, I will see an elder or somebody else walk over there and will say, that's not right. I've just listened to what you've been talking, you were cheating so and so. So that's not the way you live. And so it's not just like, you know, everybody takes care of everybody. So that when there is a misunderstanding, two sisters can take it to an elder or to the chief if they couldn't settle it by themselves. And when they do that, not that the whole world has come to an end. Once that is solved, that no, you are not right, you are in the wrong, the apologies comes in and then it's finished. So there is always sort of people trying to create a community and how to really live with each other. Sometimes you will see people really fist fighting, and then a third person will come in, or people will come And when they separate them, what they will do is sit down. What happened? And sometimes through tears, they will talk what happened. They will tell and they will say, okay, now you've beaten each other or you fight it out instead of talking it out, shake each other's hand. You do that and then you go. It's finished. So there is always, you know, and I, at first as a child, I didn't know why they do that. And so I'll ask lots and lots of questions from the elders. Why do you always want people to sort of, you know, not talk to each other? And so one day my dad told me the story about two masters. And this is a true story. There were two schoolmasters, and they didn't like each other. And somehow, what happened was, if one is stationed here, another will be stationed like 3 miles away from that one. And it happened over and over and over again, that every time they transfer them, they will go closer to a place where they sometimes do not know anybody, but they came from the same area, but they don't talk to each other. And this happened over and over again. And unfortunately, they transferred them to Tamale, where they were, I mean, the community embraced them, but they don't speak their language. They, each of the communities, like the Akans, the Gas, we speak different languages. So English is our second language that we communicate. So there they spoke English. But then the two masters could communicate with them in English, but they have their own language. But because they don't like each other, they don't socialize. It came to a point that one was very sick, and he realized he was dying. And there was nobody around but the other one whom he doesn't talk to. But he moved beyond his pride and sent a schoolboy to go call the other schoolmaster. And he died in his arms. And sort of asked for forgiveness, and the other two asked for forgiveness, and he was the one who brought the body back home from where they were working as strangers. And so I said, oh, but that's not nice. You know, as a child, I was sort of, and Dad said, that's why always the elders are trying to create an atmosphere that scenes like this won't happen. So there is always an opportunity to be able to dialogue. Another thing they taught us as children is to know the history and the culture. And proverbs are very important in Ghanaian culture because proverbs is like poems. They have lots and lots of meanings. That you say one proverb, then if you are all from the same culture, you will pick up the meaning. And sometimes one proverb carries a lot of meanings or several meanings. And so in school, they will put us as in context with each other, context. One will be here and one will be here. And then they will call you as two kids and they will ask you to compete with the other person and see who will win. Just like any other sport. And so when adults are talking and using proverbs at home, I always ask questions. I'll say, Dad, what does that mean? And I will pick up, and my grandfather was the grand master of proverbs. And so it's so interesting, the children, none of them picked it up. But as a granddaughter, I was the one who picked it up. And now I have a big book. I've written about 1,300 and something proverbs I'm looking for a publisher, if I can find one to publish those. But it all came from my memory. As I was studying, and when some will come, and I'll just, or sometimes I'll be talking and I'll be using the Proverbs. But they will sit you down and say, compete with the other person. And when they will start like, close your eyes. And then he or she will say, open your eyes. And when you open, they will say, what dream did you dream? And the other person will say, if you don't sleep, you don't dream. And that puts you immediately into dialogue. And so the Proverbs will be following. So not only are you learning what the culture significance of being able to live with each other, but you are learning the tools and the skills to communicate with each other. So they, as you grow up and a certain age, they will teach you, intentionally teach you as a girl, this is how your body works. This is who you are. At a certain stage in your life, something else is going to change this. And so when you get to that stage, don't hide it. It's important. And then they will explain to you why it's important. They believe that when a child is born, there are angels that guide the child. And the angels will be with that child for that 8 days that the child is indoors with the mother. On the 8th day, when the naming ceremony, that's part of the importance of this naming ceremony also. They pour libation, they give thanks to God, they share food, they do a lot of things. Also, so that the angels, when they go back, or the spirit, when they go back, they will have something good to report in the spirit world that the newborn has been received into the family well. And so they will do that. Another area where it's important is if a girl, when the girl has the first period, the first menstruation, if you hide it, boy, you are in trouble. Because when they discover it, it's a real, I mean, even in some tribes, it's a taboo. When you don't tell it, and they see you pregnant. Because they have another area, some things they have to do for you as a girl. When you are growing up as a child, this is a normal dressing for a Ghanaian woman. But as a child, this is your cloth, the top and the bottom, or sometimes just a dress. When you come of age, they start giving you half piece. This is half piece, 12 sassiats. I have this skirt, the top, and this one. What this means is that when you have your baby, this is what you put the baby on your back with. So when you see the Africans carrying the babies on their back, this is what they do. This is what you tie the baby with. You put the baby, if you have a 4-year-old here, I'll put the baby on my back and show it to you. And then you tie this here, and the baby will stay on your back. And that's why when you get your period, it's important. They will treat you like as though you were a princess. The family will give you everything that a woman needs. Your lavender, your clothing, your necklace, and they really honor you with that. The Ashantis, if you are not in school, actually they sit you in state for 8 days. Where the local girls will come and serve you. They will bring firewood, they will bring water, they will bring food, and they will be drumming and dancing. And the whole village, you have people that will go, the elders. And it's done by the old people. And then the young people will follow, just singing with them. And they announce to the community that this has happened. Now we have a woman among us. because all along you've just been a child. Now we have a woman among us, and they will sit you in state for that week, and people will come and give you gifts. Men will come. When they come, there are several reasons for their coming to that party. Number one, it is a warning to them. You can't joke. If you used to play with this person in an uncalled way, don't do it again. She is a woman. Don't hold her hand in public like that, just pull or anything. There are certain parts of your body, the respect that is only for your husband. So when you come of age, and all this is instructions, they teach you as you are coming up, so that you know. The boys also get instructions how to be a good father, so they know. So the elders, your family, including the elders in the village, will teach you how really to be a good parent, a good mother. How to provide for your children as well as the children within the community. Not just yours alone, but the children in the community. They are going to be looking to you as their mother. And so they teach you all this as you are growing up. And so when you come to that stage, they put you there so that people know that this has happened, this is not a kid anymore. It's a young woman. The other thing is when people are looking for a wife, that's another time also, that they will come to the family and investigate. The man won't come, but the man's family will come and investigate if it's okay if they get the hand for their son. And the other thing that is important that they do that is the background of your family is very important to the culture. You are not going to come in as a stranger that nobody knows you, and then ask that, I love this woman, or a woman will come and a man will, they say, go back home. Find who this person is. Is this a responsible human being? What is in the background? Sometimes you bring somebody home and the next time you know they are killers, or they are thieves, or they are, so go investigate into the family. And that's the other part of the community coming together. So before this happens, this marriage takes place, the community, all they know each other. And so it's like security system. We don't have, you know, security systems as you do here, but that's kind of the security that people have in Africa, to be able to ground the person so that when there is an issue between them, when the children come, they are going to be with the community again, the larger community. So they don't want somebody to come in that they do not know, and before you know, it takes only one spark to light a fire. And there is all this conflict going on. And I will come to my own life and tell you some of the importance of this. That happened to me. So this is part of how they raise you up. And as those of us who started going to school, when you were in school, everything is different. Because when you were educated, it's like you want to go and work, you want to go and do this. So sometimes we will say we want to travel. And so because of that, so many things are happening within the culture that in the time I was growing up as a child didn't happen, which is sometimes the girl and the man will fall in love, but still they will come home. They will bring the person home so that whatever the culture needs to do, the investigation and the things like that will go on. To bring it to me personally, When I grew up, I married for 10 years. I raised my kids before I decided to call it a quit. And I decided to call it a quit because of some of these things I'm talking about. I was stubborn, and my dad, because he was very gentle and kind, said, if you fall in love with somebody else and you really are in love with the person, instead of going with this, what society will say, you are all educated people, I'll let you do what you want to do. And so when I finished school, I was innocent, I was naive, even though I was a strong-headed girl. I was very naive. I didn't know any man from the man I married. And what happened, even that marriage to happen, was that I said I will never marry in my life. I was going to be a policewoman, or go into the army, or be a nurse. I want to dedicate my life to work of charity. And so my applications were out when I went to visit my mother. And this man, Mr. Boateng, who was my ex-husband, was my brother's friend, best friend. And they knew him, but I didn't know him. He was from a different tribe, and I was from a different tribe. And they were really fussing at me that, look, you are 18, going to 19. You're still just walking like on tame horse. You know, nobody can really say. I was still fighting. I was just acting like a little boy. And so they were all concerned that, you know, if nothing happened, I'm just going to be walking just like that. But deep down in my heart, I said to myself, I want to work. And if I want to, I really had in mind that I want to travel abroad from home, just travel around. And so I said to my mother, Mom, Mr. Boateng is coming here. And the idea is that they are going to talk to you to marry me. I told him that if you say yes, I will marry him. If you say no, I will not. So, Mom, please say no. And I left. And that's my honesty. I mean, you ask me, that's what you get. I don't know how to lie, because that's how I was raised up. So I went and told my mother. And guess what? My brothers went to my mother and said, look, you know how she is. She's going to walk around like that, and somebody is going to get her pregnant. And then she will come home, and you may not even find the man, because she's going to beat the boy, and the boy will disappear. I mean, they coaxed my mom. And so when the man got there, my mother said yes. And when my mother said yes, I didn't know how to say no, because I've already given my word of honor that if my mother says yes, I will marry him. And so I did. I married him, and when he took me to his tribe, that's where the conflict started. His family couldn't accept me. They said, why? Why would you go and marry a fancy woman? And I tried, and he said, that's the person I love, and that's who I want to marry. And I tried, and I tried, and I tried for 10 years. They still won't accept me. I mean, I would do everything. But then they will ask him, when are you going to come to marry home? And so one day, and as I was raised with prayer and God, all through this, I was praying. And my prayer to God was, God, I always rely upon you, be honest and truthful. And so, help me, if this is not right, get me out of it. And I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed. I have my little altar, and I've continued there tradition I was given. So always where I've been, I have my altar. And so one Christmas, I think it was December 16th, I was praying that evening in front of my altar, and it was like a light. Ding. This is it. So I got up. We didn't fight. I just got up and I said, I'm out of here. And he thought I was joking. And I said, I'm not married, I'm out of here. And I said to the family, I said, you know, he's your son, you can have him. But I'm not your daughter, so I'm out of here. So I packed my bag and off I went. And it hurt him so terribly, he was so mad that I did that. For 3 years he wouldn't talk to me. And unfortunately that time I've lost all my own children except one. And so I have one adopted one. And so he said, if you are not going to marry me, take your son with you. I said, well, he's not a piece of land, you know. So I took my son and off I went. And it didn't really, you know, it wasn't a fight, it wasn't anything, but once that voice came, I've been praying all these years for help. When that help came, I never looked back. And I went to my dad and I said, Dad, this is it, it's finished. He said, well, if it's finished with you, I don't have anything to say. And so that's the kind of events the family and the tribe try to protect. That if it hasn't been for my brothers, that this person has been a friend of theirs for years, and they sort of respect him, he was a good man, a very loving, kind man, it would not have happened, because it would have been in a neighborhood where they would be able. And his family's complaint was that, look how far we are. And if there is anything happening in the family, how do we go? We cannot attend, which is very important. Funerals, events in the family, they want the two families to be able to be together. And they live in the mountains. And it's really very hard for them to travel to the coast. And so one could understand, but you would think that after years, you will sort of give up. But when it wasn't happening, I said, part of being loving is to let the other person be free. So I'm just going to let you be free. And so I took that part and acted it out. But it's part, I was able to do that because of what the community had done for me. I was strong. I know how my mind works. My body and soul and mind work together. One doesn't do something without the others. It's like what I feel inside here is the whole body is together, mind, spirit, and soul together. So when there's something going on, and I will pray and I will ask, something will happen. And when that happens, I take it as the right path, or I won't be here today. So this is part of some of what the cultural aspect of living in a community is. They want to raise you up to become a contributing human being in the community, not only for yourself and for your descendants, but for everybody else in the community. Because if one person starts creating something that is evil, it's going to affect everybody, not just one person. And so sometimes they will tell you stories that will help you make your mind. Another story I remember Dad told me was, I used to be so justice-minded that if you punch me, you can run 10 miles, I'll follow you, and I'll punch you too. Because, and it, you know, even as a child, I did that. I mean, you cannot just punch me and walk away, and I won't forgive you. And my dad will always say, you have to learn to forgive, because forgiveness is very important. Sometimes the best thing to do is to forgive. And I, even as a child, I went to Sunday school, and they were talking about, you know, the scriptures. And I remember very well, because the teacher said, was saying something about, you know, the why Jesus was killed, and then I was so mad and I was crying. Why do they have to kill Jesus? He was somebody's child. Why did they have to kill Jesus? And the woman was trying to help me and said something like, you know, Jesus is very kind. That's why Jesus said, when somebody slaps you on the other cheek, you know, turn the other one. And I looked at her in horror and I said, if that's who Jesus is, I don't like him. I like Moses better. Even as a child, you see, I want fairness. When you treat somebody fair, somebody else is going to treat you fair. And so my dad had to really work very hard on that kind of process to turn me around. Always talking to me, telling me stories. And one of the stories that really made impression on me was the story about a man and a man living closer to my dad. And the man always wears a hat. Every day he has a hat. And I didn't know that that hat on his head is covering something. It was a big scar on his head. And it happened because of their parents. This man who has the scar here was then a little boy. And the parents had conflict. And the conflict because one hurt the other. And the parents didn't know any better. And as the other child, it was a stone. The kid was throwing a stone and didn't watch that the other kid was there, and the stone hit the boy. And it cracked, I think, a little bit on the forehead. And the father was so mean and asked the son to throw a stone at the other boy. And because it was intentional, gazing at the boy, it hit the boy here. And it really made a big dent. And since then, it has not happened. The hair has not grown there. So the man wears this hat. And it didn't end there. The fathers created it for the son, and then the son created it for their children. And in the end, it only got solved when one of the children died in the conflict. And then the parents came to their senses that, you know, what we are planting here is going to go on generations if we don't cut it. But somebody has to die in order for them to. And stories like this, the community gathers. And so sometimes they will, when you are doing something that is bad, leading to that kind of event, they will say in a proverb, infidenepi wombo. And translating in English says, what I saw last year must not be repeated. And if you understand proverbs, you hear that, then you start looking around, it's a warning. If even you are walking and you hear that proverb said, you stop and you look around, because it's a warning that something terrible happened and it must not be repeated. So these are some of the things the culture help you as you are growing, so that you will become a viable member in the community. Now it's over to you. I've given you too many things to ask questions or think about. So,
You talked about when a girl comes of age. When does a boy come?
Maybe the boy will be 18 or sometimes 20, depending upon the work the parents do, or depending on the work the boy wants to do, maybe 20. Because they will guide you as a child to follow the men, whatever trade. Even though you are in school, you will still follow the men, whatever trade they are doing, and things like that. And the woman too, at a certain stage, they separate you so that you can learn from the women and what is important, you know, how a woman keeps house, how a woman keeps family together, what a woman does to turn things around, nurturing kind of things. So they sort of try to gear you toward where you will learn that skills.
Do you have any tradition about like a namesake being named for someone?
Yeah, all people are named for somebody in
living,
my culture.
Living or deceased?
Sometimes deceased, sometimes living. I was named for my father's grandmother. And because of that, they always call me either grandma or mom. Even the uncles, my uncles and my great uncles in the family. If my aunt was still living, great grand aunt was dead, and so I was named after her. So that great aunt used to call me mom, even when I was little. And the significance of that is when they do that, when the parents name this, they have to respect that child. And I have seen it happen with my own eyes, that parents have bought gin and gone to the family and said, take the name of that child and give the child another name. If you gave that name to the child in order to insult me, then take the name off. And so it's very, very important what name you give to your child and how you're going to treat that child. So the English name, they can give you any English name when you are baptized. But the age, the name they give you is the local name, either of a great aunt or grandmother or grandfather or somebody.
What are the rituals or ceremonies for the boy coming of age?
Well, sometimes what they do in Ghana, I know Kenya, they have to go out and do, I think Kenya, they have the circumcision then because they don't do it on the 8th day. But Ghanaian children, the male child is circumcised on the 8th day. So what they do is they give you a trade. If you are going to be a farmer, that's when your tools are given to you, and then they give you a land. When you are going to be a fisherman, that's when you get your tools. But if you've been to school, then you are just, you know, they don't do anything for you but to recognize. So they will sometimes go to church and give you a little party. Or they will save everything until you are married. And then they will give you some gifts from the family. But the girls, they do. When the very day they have their period, they give them what they need to have.
How is kinship determined? Is it through the women or through the men?
Through the women, Ghanaian culture is matrilineal culture. Everything is traced through the mother. And only about, I think, Kweu and Ashanti and a little bit from the north are patriarchal. everything is through the woman. And so it's very interesting how they, so you know, the Trinity never bothered the Ghanaian people because they already had this, you know, I don't know how they figured that out, but they said that a person has this three combination. And one is you have your mother's blood, you have your father's spirit, and the soul is from God. So every human being is a combination of three things. And so they trace the line through the blood. And that's why the everything is through the mother. And so is the women are treasured in the culture because they bring the children home. Even though the men are treasured within the culture, they know that when they produce, it's going to go into another tribe, not into our tribe. And so the women in the tribe are more than, you know, and sometimes they get big-headed.
We were talking last night in the forum about care of children, and mm-hmm. it's fairly understandable in a culture like that where the women are, there's a high value put on children, and the women are home with the children all the time, that mm-hmm. the children are nurtured and taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's been a while since you've been back, but are there women in that culture right now that are doing what American women are doing? Careers, leaving the home, not following this kind of path, breaking away?
Yes, they do a lot, and not. I go home every 4 years, and I did also, but it's very different. We have some women women are in offices a lot. I think it's almost like 50-50 women out there working. But the system that is so different in our culture is that you don't, when both of you are working, you still have the system there that the children are still home. Either with an aunt or with an uncle, or if even you move from the family, you live in another tribe, the elderly woman in the house is the grandmother of the children. And so you always have the system there that will take care of the children. It's not here, like, you know. And the women who are not actually doing government work harder than the women who do government work. They get up in the morning at the crack of dawn and they've gone to market, they are trading. And they've gone all day. And so when you look at Ghanaian culture, the women have money than the men. They are in control of the finances. Because every woman in that culture works. Sometimes you do a lot of different kind of trading. Here you will call it little stores. That's basically what every woman do. In Ghana, and I was a trader too before I came to the continent.
Picking up on Bob's question, mm-hmm. what about the education for women and for men? Is it equal or different? Or?
It used to be that they would let the girls stay home and let the boys go to school. In the ancient time. And then in another tribe, the girls would rather go to school and the boys would stay home because the boys will help the father's farm because they are strong. And now everything is changed because it depends on actually where the money is coming from. If there is money there, and that's why when Kwame Nkrumah during the independence time made education free so that all children
will be able to go to school. Now it's back to where they have to pay again. And so it's very, very hard for some families when you have big family. And that's where, again, the community comes into play. There are families who have money. I mean, there are people, millionaires in Ghana too. And what they do if they are in the community is that they will adopt some of the children with potentials. And then they will send them to school. They will treat them like their own children. And sometimes they will even let the child live with the parents, but they know that that's the parents or guidance of that child. And what the parents will do is, every time they will ask you, go fetch water for this family, go get firewood, or go get food from the farm, take it to the farm. It's like every time you are serving them, because they are your parents. And sometimes they just come and take the child and say, you know, this child really needs invested in, and they will do that. So everybody pitch in. So education is, if you look at Ghana, it's really surprising how many doctors, medical doctors. New York spinal surgery on 72nd Street is headed by a Ghanaian. And there are other areas. Last 3 years, a Ghanaian doctor, Kubulampo, came here for an award, because he studied here, he does the lumbar surgery. I mean, there are so many Ghanaian doctors in New York City. And then when you go home, you have all these lawyers and magistrates. The Ashanti King was a lawyer before he was taken to be a king. So education is very important in that culture.
How are you a king? How did you become a king?
Well, it's they trace the royal, you see, every tribe, we have the royals in there. And the king comes from the royal family. And every time one king dies or one queen dies, they go to the royal family again to select. And how it's done is, it comes from the woman's side. Say a woman has maybe 4 daughters. The first daughter, if the elder daughter doesn't have a son, then they will move to the second daughter. And so it goes in sequence. So until there's nobody there, then they will look to a cousin. So it's always the women. It's the queen mothers who choose the king. It's not the men. If even the men point it out and the women reject it, it's not going to happen. So sometimes when I say that, people, you know, sort of open their eyes and say, well, at least one culture, the women is in charge. You know, and so it because the women are the ones who are actually increasing the family, and so that's where the lines come from.
But it's a king, not a queen.
You have a king and you have a queen.
But the king has the...
No, they all have their areas of responsibility, and they are treated the same way. When you look into Ashanti history, we have a queen mother whose name was Yasantwa. She was the one who went to war 1900 against the British, because they arrested the Opokuware the first. That's the one they took to Cecil Isles. That's where some of the royals have spread in the British area, because they captured the king. And the queen mother said, you men, you sat here and you watched the king being captured, and now you are not going to go defend the king. So she gathered the rest of the warriors and she had them. I mean, they lost, but still she took them to war. So when you go to Ashanti someday, you go to Ghana and you visit Kumasi, they will take you to Ya Asantewaa area. And so Ya Asantewaa is very popular, but she was a queen mother of Ejoso. And we still have them. Tonight, when you see the video, I wish we had seen the video because it will have given you some areas to ask questions. But when you see the video, you will see that they are both men and women, and they both have the same responsibility. One is not under the other.
Do they run the country then, or they run the tribe?
Yeah, what that works is the government actually depends upon these tribal chiefs for harmony and security. Mm-hmm. Without them, the government wouldn't be able to really control anything. I mean, you have a small country with more than 100 different tribes, with more than 100 different languages. How do you do that if you don't have the House of Chiefs? So they have the House of Chiefs. The Ashantehene is the president, and the king from my tribe is the linguist. That's another part that is important in our culture. Before you become a linguist, you have to be really smart and wise. You have to know how to talk, how to make peace, how to negotiate. They don't just choose linguists because they are there. They are trained. And what that does is that their system is you don't talk directly to the king or to the queen. You always pass through the linguist. That's another thing that, you know, religious ideas and the cultural ideas never crashed. Because they already knew that you don't talk directly to the king or the queen. You go through the linguist. So when the Christianity came and said you have to talk through Jesus to go to God, it wasn't a problem for anybody. It's the same thing. You have to go through the linguist, yeah, in order to get it. You see, these are some of the things sometimes you see how the culture operates have effect on whatever else is going on. It was easy for them because they already have that system that is a respect that you go through the linguist. The other part of that is that if I say something nasty to the king is though sitting right there, hearing it with his own ears, or the queen is sitting right there hearing me saying you have a dirty face. She didn't hear it. She will only hear it when the linguist say it to him or to her. And so it is the linguist's job to pick it up and turn it around and say to the king, oh, they are saying that you are very nice. Even though you just heard what they said, you didn't hear it. So it's very, very important that you have a linguist who is smart and sharp and can think on his own. You know, mostly the linguists are men. Think on his feet. If not, there will always be trouble. And the other side is sometimes the king will get mad and will say something, and the whole community is there. It's the linguist's job to turn it around, face the community, and say, by the way, this is what the king is saying. And you respect and accept that. Even though you heard exactly what So that's part of what it is. So if the government is working and there is a problem in one district, all the government needs to do is to call the king or the queen and say, I'm really having a hard time getting through these people. How can I get to them? And the king knows how to mobilize the people and how to really get them to do things. Because they elected the king. And once you elected the person, you have to respect the person. And so that's how it's also, and it helps the government to really be able to govern. And sometimes I wish we have something, you know, similar, because this country is big. It's like you have the governors. You see, so our area, like the chiefs, will represent the government, what do you call governor, mm-hmm. in some cities. But then they don't have the same kind of system. So when there is a problem, sometimes the governor cannot do anything. But the king really have warriors. And he can call the warriors anytime. If there's something like, you know, a group has really band together and want to misbehave, the king has warriors. And all they need to is to beat the drum. They will call them into play just a minute. And so the government and the king has to work hand in hand, or the queen has to work hand in hand. The government cannot just go into that area and say, this is what I'm doing, and go ahead and do it without first talking to the queen or the king in the district. So that's how it functions. Anything else? Let's see how we are doing with time here before I say something to the tape. Oh! It's exactly time, and I think this is the end of the official discussion. If you want to turn the tape off, you're welcome. Now, you know, if you are not ready to move on, you have any questions, you can ask. Or tonight, you will see the video, and maybe that will generate more questions. And so, if you see me walking around and something, that you can come to me and ask me. I don't guarantee I will have the answers for you, but I'll try.
So you, when did you decide to become a sister, a priest?
Actually, the priesthood was the first, but I didn't get ordained until later. I knew I was going to be a priest when I was just 4 years old. I was just 4. And everybody thought that I was just dreaming. And even as a child, when I play games, I would say, oh, pretend I'm the priest, and I will chant. Because, you see, I was in the mission house, so I know how the priest used to. And I would go stand there as a kid and put my hands out and chant. And so that has been with me. And so when I married, everybody thought that it was just, you know, the end of it. And so when I left, I went back and started pursuing it. And I have about 6 cousins who are priests. My brother is the dean of the cathedral in Cape Coast. So they are in the family. And my dad was a catechist. And they all thought I was just, you know, being a tomboy. I want to do what the boys want to do. And I said, no. They said, well, then you have to change your denomination and go to Methodist or, you know, Baptist or Presbyterian. I said, no, I'm called to be an Anglican priest. And so after fighting and fighting, one priest said to me, why don't you just go be a nun? You'll be doing the same thing and just forget this priesthood. They won't ordain you. And so I thought that's the second best. If I won't be able to be a priest, then I'll go be a nun. And so in my thinking, I was trading
the priesthood to become a nun. And it happened in a funny way, because there were six girls who already, you know, had the vocation, and apparently this priest has already gathered them together. So I was the tag along, you know, when he said that. I said, okay, I'll go and try it. If I don't like it, I'll come back home. And so they tagged my name on, and I ended up being the only one who was chosen. So I took it to be that maybe God was working through the person who made this suggestion. And then when I came, I thought that I've already traded one for the other. And then the priesthood wouldn't go away. If there was any time I was so miserable, I was hunted with the whole thing. And so the community saw the frustration and aggravation, and they said, you know, why don't you just, since this country ordains women, go ahead and do it. And we have three other priests in the community. So I ended up getting both. I guess that's how God works.
You were raised as an Episcopalian?
I was raised as an Anglican. Yeah, yeah, and born and bred Anglican, and I'm still Anglican. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And tonight when you see the tape, maybe.